Welcome to this audio presentation. My name is Dr. Scott Taransky.
And I'm Joanne Miller. We represent the National Center for Biblical Parenting. Our goal is to help parents and churches have the tools they need to work with children, helping children address their hearts, not just their behavior.
Now, this presentation you're about to listen to was recorded before a live audience. So let's go and listen to exactly what this presenter has to say.
Well, good morning. I'm Phil Downer. And together with my two kids, Paul and Anna, we're going to talk about building vibrant, healthy relationships. And that's a wonderful title. That's a wonderful goal. But what do you do when you've got problems, you've got sin, you've got challenges, you bring into your marriage, you bring into your family a lot of pain? How do you overcome that? How do you deal with that? And we'll be talking about that biblically and also practically. What is it we want for our children? What we really want for our children and what we want to be in our family, I think, is really outlined in the life of Gideon. We take a look at the life of Gideon in Judges 7, and we see some interesting things about his leadership style. First of all, he's like you and me. I want plenty of resources, plenty of time, plenty of help. And so he started out with 10,000 soldiers to fight the enemy, the crushing enemy. Well, the Lord said, no, that's too many. So he narrowed it down to 7,700. Well, that's too many. And out of that, he ended up with 300. He had this massive army, and he ended up with 300. You and your family, here you are in your marriage, your first marriage, your second marriage, your first child, your second child, how many children you have. You're sitting here feeling very understaffed, overwhelmed, too much to do, not enough help, all these things. That's where Gideon was. But Gideon had a leadership principle that really revolutionized his life and military history. As we look in Judges 7, he said this, the Lord said this, and he divided the 300 men into three companies and put them with trumpets, empty pitchers in their hands, and torches inside the pitcher. And then he said to them four things. His strategy was four strategies. Number one, he said, look at me. Watch what I do. He's a leader. Number two, imitate me. Number three, come with me into the battle. And number four, do as I do in the battle. So in the battle of life, in life, what we really want our children to do is to watch us, imitate what we do, come with us in the battle, and fight as we fight. Now, the problem is that we sometimes say, well, we don't want them to imitate the bad stuff, but they imitate the good and the bad and the ugly. In my life, I brought into the family a lot of pain. I grew up in a home with a dad that was always with other women. I didn't understand adultery as a little boy. I just knew it was bad because mom would cry. And so there we are growing up in Colorado Springs. And I remember that day I came home from school. My mother was just racked with pain, anger, and despondency. I came home and couldn't find her. I yelled, Mom, Mom, are you here? And I found her on the bottom of the stairs in a pool of blood after her first attempted suicide. Another time, after she came back from the institution, my friends called the Nut House. My friends, those wonderful guys that I thought would kind of help me, made fun of me. And they didn't know what to do. They were embarrassed. They didn't know, but they just made fun of me. We don't know what to do sometimes in hard times. And so I came home another time, and I couldn't wake her up. Dad, I can't wake her up. I can't wake her up. And so I grew up with a lot of pain and uncertainty. Well, then, went off to school. I continued my father's ways of drinking and partying, looking for success and money and all those kinds of things. Didn't know Christ. He didn't know Christ. And went off to high school, cheated my way through high school, went off to college, and flunked out of college. So here I am in college, flunked out of the college my father had been student body president of. I'm 19 years old. I don't like to be told what to do. I don't like regimentation, and I don't like authority, and I don't like to get up early in the morning. So what do you think I did? I joined the Marine Corps. Perfect. Perfect logic. I didn't like my father's rules, so I joined the Marine Corps. So I joined the Marine Corps, went off and fought in Vietnam in 1967-68, and once again was involved in a lot of trauma. Twice in two operations. We called them search and destroy missions. We lost 25 to 30% of our men dead or wounded in 90 seconds. Men died in my arms. And to kind of summarize, in two particular battles, one a three-day battle, one a two-day battle, we loaded so many dead and wounded on helicopters, my buddies, in pieces. I couldn't lift my arms. It was just one of those horrible experiences. Came home, and like you, you went through trauma, probably worse than mine, perhaps. I never remember anybody I really trusted who physically hurt me. That might have happened to you. The very people who are supposed to have taken care of you did you in. I don't know what your background's been, but you've had trauma in your life. I had mine, you had yours. The problem is, I just assumed when I got married, it would go away. I had this girl I loved, 19 years old. I met Susie at SMU in Dallas. She was beautiful. She loved me. She kissed me till my lips fell off, you know. We had a wonderful marriage, and the problem was I had all that trauma and hurt. I had no place to put it, and where it came out, as we talked about in one of the sessions last night, it spilled out all over her. What do you do when you live with someone who's wounded? They wound you. What do you do when you live with someone who's insensitive? They're insensitive to you. What happens when you deal with somebody who's insecure and you live with someone who's very insecure? They try to find their security in you. And guess what? You never measure up. You can never perform to satisfy another person. So that's what happened. And very quickly, I destroyed our marriage. Susie was about to leave me. Here we were in Atlanta, Georgia. We both went to law school at Emory Law School. Got graduated. We had good jobs, fabulous jobs. We had everything and were miserable. And my Susie was about to divorce me, and a man impacted my life. What he did is he parented me. I want to talk to you about parenting through trauma and how we might do that. Your kids may be 2 or 32, but as people, we have trauma, and we are challenged with that. We have trauma with one another. We get under pressure. We hurt one another. We have an argument in front of the kids. Well, they're only 2 or 3. They can't hear. They don't understand. Yes, they do. They can feel that tension. They can feel that pout. They can feel that withhold of affection. They can feel that hurt. They hear the tone, the words. So what we're doing is we're sowing the seeds. Come with me, watch me, and do what I do, and follow my instruction as I lead into battle. If in battle we're shooting our own people, if in battle we're shooting friendly troops, our children grow up and learn how to do that. And we've all done that. We've all done that. There's some really good news at the end of this, and that is how to change that. And what happened to me is I had a man who discipled me. He spiritually parented me, and I learned how to parent my children through the man who parented me. We have 6 children, 3 boys, 3 girls. They're not perfect. They're all Christians. They love the Lord. They're all making disciples in their sphere of influence and where God's placed them. And they all love each other. And I was off with my 18-year-old on a father-daughter weekend, well, 5-day senior trip. And we were sitting at dinner one night, and she said, "You know, Daddy, everybody in our family gets along. There are no issues among us." Now, for that to have come from me in our home is a miracle. And we're going to unpack in the next few minutes ahead the miracles of how to do that, the practical ways of doing that. The very first thing this man did with me is he built a relationship with me of trust. Your children need to be able to trust you. And you say, "Well, I'm your mom, I'm their dad." They don't automatically trust you. What I mean by that is they don't automatically believe that you want to hear what they have to say. They don't automatically believe that you have answers for their problems and that you're trustworthy with their bad stuff and their good stuff. The man that discipled me right here in Atlanta built trust with me. Once a week, he met with me, built a relationship of trust by listening and asking me questions and caring about my life. He would ask me highly technical, deeply theological questions like this. Tough questions. Write these down. Would be there on North Avenue in Atlanta, here in Atlanta, and he'd lean over the table, and he'd look at me, and he'd say, "Phil, how are you doing?" And he would do the most bizarre thing. He would stare at me with these big, dumb eyes. And then was perfectly quiet. as though he was expecting me to answer the question and he would listen. And so it kind of go like this. It'd say, Phil, how are you doing? He built trust, confidentiality, and I began to share my heart with him, my struggles with him. And I learned how to parent because a man parented me. I found that going out with my children, sitting down with them, activities are great, ideas are great. We had some great ones this morning. But the key for me has been to spend that weekly time with my children one-on-one. I just figured if a doctor in Atlanta who hated lawyers would meet with a lawyer for an hour a week, doesn't it make sense I could meet with my kids for an hour a week? Well, how old do you start doing that? Well, 2. When they can walk, I'd carry them around, would go out in the backyard, go down the street. Susanna was reminding me, she said, Daddy, you remember when we took my cat up to the park and put the cat on a leash and tried to walk my cat on a leash? And she was just, in the middle of this restaurant 3 nights ago, she was just howling, remembering that. It was so silly, but she never forgot it. Good ideas. But the key is it would be relaxed in the spirit, enjoying them. I came to Christ, my wife relented. She did something really bizarre. This is so bizarre. The secret to a family. You know what she did? She forgave me. If you're living in a home and you haven't forgiven, you got to begin there. Forgive, 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 forgive. I talked to a man last night. Godly guy, headed toward divorce. He said, I'm tired of forgiving. I'm tired of trying. What a tragedy. Forgive, forgive. And then spend time with your kids one-on-one. And then I wanted to teach them family devotions. I know family devotions are not a lot of fun unless you make them fun. And one of the keys to family devotions is being willing to ask these questions. What, and so what? Write those down. What, and so what? So what I wanted to do is once a day, I made a decision. If I'm home and if I'm alive, I'm going to teach family devotions. The first family devotion is one that's prepared, figured out. I got an illustration. I got an egg that's going to explode or whatever it's going to do. And as an illustration. The second family devotion would be I haven't prepared, but I've spent time with the Lord. So I simply share with my kids what I'm learning from the Lord. That's the second family devotion. What about the third family devotion? Well, there is no third family devotion. If I'm not prepared, haven't had a quiet time, you know what I do? I leave. You know, in Vietnam, with the enemy coming up over the hill, Ralph on a machine gun, there I am. I didn't want to be there some days. Some days I was tired. Some days we had no ammo. We had no food, no sleep, pouring down rain, the stench of death, rats everywhere. You know, I really wanted to say, hey, Ralph, take care of it. I don't feel very good about fighting the NVA today. I never did that. I never left my foxhole buddy. I stayed, and I was what we say in the Marines, semper fidelis, always what? Always faithful. I stood in that. So when I walked out without teaching family devotions, I really felt like I'd left my wife. See, if I wasn't willing to walk with the Lord and teach, why would they be willing to walk with the Lord and learn? So I decided I'd stay there, and I had to develop a third idea on how I would teach family devotions when I had no idea, no clue, couldn't remember the sermon Sunday, had nothing to say. And so I developed the 1-inch Bible study. Go like this. 1, 2, 3, boom. Go like that. Come on up. 1, 2, 3, boom. All right, now we're going to pick a verse at random, all right, sort of at random. Okay, somebody say stop. All right, here we go. All right. Now, what you do is you don't know what you're going to teach. So you go, 1, 2, 3, boom. All right. Here we go. That's our family devotion for the day. Get the kids together. Okay. I want you to read. We'd like you to read 1 Thessalonians 2:4. And so the kids would read it. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing of men, but of God, who examines our hearts. Okay, so what, and so what? Now, the idea is teaching a family devotion when you have nothing, no idea on what to say. Ask God to be there. All right, the first what is, what does it say? I'm not sure, Daddy, what that said. We'll read again. We'll read again. And the older ones are reading. The younger ones are listening. Anna didn't speak in family devotions for about 6 years because the others were talking and she was a little girl. And then finally she started to speak and suddenly it was really interesting. So what does it say? What does it mean? Well, it means that we've been entrusted with the gospel. Well, what's it mean to you? Well, I've been entrusted with the gospel. That's great. What does it say? What does it mean? What's it mean to you? So what are you going to do about it? Those are the four questions that get you talking. And pretty soon when the kid says, well, I've been entrusted with the gospel. Man, I've been entrusted with the gospel. Maybe I need to share it. Maybe I need to share. Great idea. Who could you share it with? Well, how about Johnny? How about Joey? How about somebody else? And suddenly you've got a conversation breaking out around the Word of God and you had nothing to teach. Now, it's best to be prepared. It's best to have verses and all the things we've talked about at this conference. But when you haven't, don't leave your foxhole buddy to fight the enemy and walk out. Stand with the troops. Stand with your fellow Marines. And as Gideon said, do as I do. Watch what I'm doing and spend time in the Word. So I wanted to do that. After our marriage here in Atlanta was just crushed, I crushed it. Broke my wife's heart, her dreams. I broke our marriage vows. She was ready to divorce me. She wasn't going to hire a lawyer. She was a lawyer. She was just going to sue me for divorce. And she forgave me and came to know Christ and prayed for new love for me. Our marriage was restored and our children, six children, then came along and we began discipling Limit. And everything was just fine. It was just perfect.
Wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Things weren't even close to perfect. That's what you thought. That's what you thought. There were issues. There were issues to work through.
Issues.
Yeah, issues. Well, hey, I'm Paul, and I'm the second oldest of six kids in our family. And, you know, yeah, Dad learned a couple things, and he was growing and working through stuff, you know, with Mom. And a couple years later, they have my older sister, Abigail. Then 2 years after she's born, I come along, and we start growing up. But there's continual residual fallout in our family. And I'm sure you all have experienced in your families how you never actually quite fully just kind of get past your background. The past is kind of a misnomer because it's not really past. It's still a part of your present in some way. It's a little tricky to figure out how all that works. But really you can't escape from the things that have happened to you by just kind of turning and ignoring them, because when you kind of run away from the things that have been negative or hurtful or wounded you, or memories that you'd really rather not think about, and you just try to kind of ignore those things, you wind up kind of running in a certain direction thinking you're escaping the things from your past or the example you had of a father or a mom or a mentor or someone that really let you down and hurt you. But the things that you run from, you don't escape from them. You actually begin to be driven by them. And the things that drive you ultimately define you. And so in our family, we were beginning to see that. You don't actually escape from the things you run from. They drive you, and then they define you. And so in our family, my dad is trying to understand every day what it means to grow in his relationship with Christ and to let his relationship with God, his Heavenly Father, be his source. But he's still in process. But then all of a sudden, he has to be a dad. So he has to be a dad, and he has to parent and be a father when he's still in the middle of being fathered by God. And he's thinking, how in the world am I going to do this? And in our family, I want you to know it was not some perfect process. In fact, that statement that we can now say that now in our family, after all these years, now that I'm, you know, 28 and we range in age from 18 to 30 for the six of us, We do live in a state of harmony and closeness in our relationships, but for just years, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, Mom actually would, sometimes we were all kids, and she'd be trying to train us and teach us and help us, and, you know, she tried about 15 different methods on chore books. Right? You know? And like, do you even fight to have a hamper? A hamper's just one more place kids won't put their clothes. You know, I mean, there's already the drawer, their bodies, and the washer, and they're going to invent a fourth location for them to kind of misappropriate, you know, and it's just frustrating. And sometimes Dad would come home and Mom would be sitting on the living room floor, just with just toys everywhere. And, you know, just like she looks disheveled and we're just going crazy and we're arguing and we're discussing, and she's just crying. She's just sobbing, and she's like, and I remember one day in particular that she looked up and she's, you know, she's sniffling. It's just heartbreaking now to think about it. At the time, I'm kind of like, I mean, why are you crying? This is what we do every day. You know, we're just living life here. This is normal. And she was crying, and she said, if someone walked into our family, into our house right now, they wouldn't think that any of us were Christians. And she's just thinking, you know, like, is this really what family life is like? And for a lot of years, it was. For a lot of years, it was messy and hard and discouraging. But the key to my parents' impact in our lives is that they were willing to let God use them to parent us while He was still parenting them. And I think that's really, really hard to do. It's hard to give to others when you're still in process. I think we have this idea in churches and just American culture that the real people who are heroes are the ones who have arrived on some level. They're the ones who don't get to the Super Bowl. They win the Super Bowl. And then you notice how they narrow things down, you know? I mean, how many hundreds of thousands of kids every year play football? And then you have the ones that make it on a scholarship to college. Then you have the ones that are first string. Then you have the ones that actually get played on first string, don't get injured. Then you have the teams that actually make it into these different bowls. Then they have the ones that win the championships. Then you get drafted to the NFL. Then you have to make it to the playoffs. And then you have to actually make it to win the Super Bowl, because the person who loses the Super Bowl is a loser. And then you wind up with a microphone in front of the person's face, the one person's face that year, who's the MVP on the winning team of the team that won the Super Bowl for the NFL. And it's kind of implied that everybody except that one guy's face for that one 60-second interview just didn't quite make it this year. And we got to be honest, that's a very, very strange culture where we kind of cull the herd down to this one person just so the rest of us can feel like we're almost there or we're not even close. And I actually think there's a similar attitude in the Christian church, in lots of different areas, but including the areas of parenting, where I feel like even as a single young adult right now, I'm 28 years old, I'm tempted, even though I don't have kids or spouse or family or all these other criteria by which to evaluate my own performance as a Christian, I walk into church and I'm immediately tempted to start grading myself or others based on how we size up. And we have all these superficial ways of signaling how we're doing. You know, I mean, you've got the size of the Bible or the width of the grin. And so pretty soon you start to see through those things. And you're like, man, everybody's just a bunch of fakes. But meanwhile, we feel tempted to fake it too. And so all this to say, beyond the specifics, I think the number one thing that my parents did during those tough years that wound up coming to this place in our family of restoration and close relationships and genuine faith is that they hung in there and they were willing to let God use them to parent us while they were still being parented by God. In other words, they were willing to be faithful to love others while they were still in process as children of God themselves. And so what would happen is when we would begin to see our parents in moments of just not quite technical emotional breakdown, but they're having an emotional break. You know, Mom's crying and Dad comes home and he gets mad. He's frustrated and he's thinking, you know, this place looks like World War III. You know, I haven't fought in that particular war, but I feel like I'm living there right now. And you know, he'll start to like list off all these different things. And at the time as a kid, I was just thinking, Dad, I got to be honest, I don't really care about the electrical bill and the doors not being locked and crime in the neighborhood and I shouldn't leave my bike out because it's going to rust and I didn't pick up my toys in my room. Like, I've got priorities, Dad. I'm 11 years old. I have a social life. I really need to go out and have some free time and hang out with Nick and go build some forts. Like, this is my worldview as a kid, you know? I mean, the silliest thing in the world to an 11-year-old is an adult who's stressed out It's just the most ridiculous thing ever. We're thinking, you know what? There are enough cookies for everyone. I mean, what can be wrong in the world? Last time I checked, you know, hanging out outdoors is still free, and that's all that really matters in life. And so what is your issue here? I mean, I used to go to Christmas reunions, and I, at 10 years old, I seriously thought that once you become an adult, your life is over. There's no more fun. There is no more, you know, whatever. And I thought this because, not because my parents didn't have a ton of fun with me, because they did. My dad was very, very assertive about entering our worlds, having fun with us. But when I saw him doing what he wanted to do, a lot of times it was standing in a little circle with adults having polite conversation. And I thought to myself, that is exactly what I never, ever want to wind up doing even a little bit of. You know, I want to cause a ruckus. I want to go like build something or break something. You know, I want to like go sledding or, you know, something like that. And so then I was thinking, you know, I can't relate to these adults. It was like a cross-cultural experience every time I talked to one. And so meanwhile, my parents are trying to figure out, how do you parent and reach the heart of a child that's just so disconnected in that way? And what I began to realize later in life is the sacrifice it takes for you parents to move past the goofy values that your kids have when they're disrespectful to you and when they make a massive battle over one tiny little thing they get fixated on, like their schedule, or you promised I was going to be able to go out and ride bikes, and you're like, yeah, that's before the washer broke and I couldn't do any of the laundry, and now I have to go to the laundromat before our trip, which is all about you going to the beach anyway, and you don't understand this stuff. It's just like, but you're a liar, you promise, you know, it's just, that's all that matters. And then they start on this like high horse of justice, right? I'm a 7-year-old. I know about justice. I know about lying. I've learned that in Sunday school. Lying is terrible, Mom. How could you lie to me? How could you lie to me? You know? And it just becomes this really strange court of law. But then God, in his own beautiful sense of humor, decided to give me just a real lifestyle experience of what it's like to be a parent before ever having to be a parent. A year and a half ago, I moved into a house that I planned to spend 2 months renovating. And 2 years later, when I was done renovating it, and I finally had it how I wanted, I moved in with a bunch of college guys, who are also Young Life leaders in Chattanooga. And that's one of the partnerships we have, is that Ann and I are both Young Life leaders there and get to invest in the high schoolers in Chattanooga. And so I'm living in this house, and I'm 28, and they range in age from about, 19 to 23, and there are 8 of them. And so in the beginning, I'm like, okay. You know, Dad and I already have this really restored, strong relationship after all these years of working through things and growing together. But I still in my mind think, yeah, but when I'm in charge of a house, boy, am I going to do things differently. I'm going to be the cool guy who never mentions a rule, never says anything negative about anything. And they're all just going to think, yeah, that guy, he's the best. You know, I mean, he's not in college anymore, but he is cool. He is like really, you know. And so I do really great for about a month. Solid month, you know. I walk in the house, and I don't say a word, no matter what. No matter how crazy it looks, it's okay. No matter how, and you know, just with the fact that all the lights are on, and the utilities are included in the rent, so it's not out of their pocket, you know, when it just goes through the roof. And they're all taking, like, 6-hour showers, and they're like, why is there no hot water? And I'm like, do the math, I don't know, you know. Like, you could think through that, maybe, and come up with an idea about that. You know, the doors are always unlocked, and they leave all their scooters and bikes in the front yard. And then 2 months later, they're like, hey, weren't there like 4 scooters out here? And now they're 2? And I'm like, yeah, that's called crime. We're in the world where sin happened. You should read about that. And they're like, oh yeah, we should have locked those. I'm like, yeah, I probably should have, you know. And then one night I come home and there is stuff all over the floors, all the lights are on, and there's like nobody home, and all the doors are unlocked, and then they come home, and they bring in all these different friends with them too. And I go back in my room, and I'm like working on something or whatever, and one of the guys goes, hey, Paul, come here, look, we made a huge fire. And so I come out to the dining room. We have a fire pit in the side yard, okay? We have a fire pit. It's for fires. and it's about this big. Well, they had loaded it full of like 5 wood pallets that are just huge, about this high. I'm in a residential neighborhood. And I come out to the, and I have these double French doors with, you know, 5 windows in each. And I open them up, and it's just like, and it's just huge. And I'm like, Nate, grab the hose. He turns on the hose, and it was actually catching outside the fire pit, about 4 feet in each direction. There are these oak log chunks. They're just like these huge cross sections of a trunk of an oak tree. And they are catching fire. And it's moving toward the woods. And there's this house next door that we were about to burn to the ground. And we barely got this thing put out. Barely. Before it just took over the whole neighborhood. And this was the moment when I changed parenting styles. I lined them up in the living room. And I said, we're about to have a conversation. And I want you guys to tell me first what should be in the conversation before I even really go through my list. And they're like, we shouldn't have built such a big fire. I'm like, number one, yes. What else? We're not done. We should have asked before building a huge fire. It's like, we covered that. What else? You know? And so I'm trying to like talk to them about like, take responsibility. And so in this moment, I began to realize the genius of my dad over all those years where he's trying to balance this thing called truth and love. And it's so hard when you come back from the office or when you come back from errands, you come back from your work. As a man or woman, wherever you are during the day or wherever you're doing in the morning, and you walk in, from the living room or your office into the kid's bedroom, and you're confronted with all the stresses of your past and your life story and the stresses of your day, and you're thrown into a crisis situation where your kid is just doing crazy things. And you have to figure out how to be loving and still confront the issue. Because the first month or so, in the interest of just kind of like not being controlling or not being something, which we all have an idea in our heads of something we don't want to be, that we think, you know, I don't want to be that extreme over here. But then it could push us to another extreme where I was just not engaging the issues until it came to a place where we almost burned the neighborhood down. And then I go to the other extreme where I'm lining people up and I'm really like tense and frustrated. I'm not at my best moment at all because I've avoided it until I had to just kind of grab control of the situation. And neither of those models is appropriate. And I want to share with you 5 ideas on what my dad did to just really balance truth and love. And not just kind of going to one extreme of saying, I want to be the cool guy, I want to be the cool mom or the cool dad, and just never really step on your toes and be your buddy and not actually train you in character. So to avoid that extreme of silence, but also avoid the extreme of just always being the one who leans on the excuse of, well, I'm telling you the truth. And really it comes out like someone who's always lecturing or someone who's always kind of giving you a character audit. You know, hi, I'm Dad, I'm from the IRS, and you're being audited, you know. So here are 5 ideas. Number one, my dad was quick to admit his mistakes. He was quick. When my dad would be frustrated or tense or come home from the office, and he knew that he had allowed kind of the stress of his day to overflow in another situation. You know, 20 minutes later, he'd come back. And he'd say, hey, that interaction that we just had, it really didn't go the way it should have, and it's my fault. Even though I had huge fault in it. I mean, I was an irritable guy. And let me tell you this. At 12 years old, I was a liar, mainly because I didn't really like the totalitarian rules in the house that rationed our desserts and sweets. I thought that was terrible. So I would lie to get what I deserved, which was more cake any time. And so I became dishonest. I was lazy. I would try to get out of chores all the time. I mean, at the end of dinner, I used to say, oh, I've really got a stomachache. I've got to go to the bathroom. Because I figured out at like 7 years old that you eat on dishes and then you always have to clean them. And this is the sequence that usually occurs in. By 7, I was like, oh, I want the first part, but not the second part. Okay. And so I got this excuse and I'd go to the bathroom. And it just so happened that these stomach aches were always about 40-minute stomach aches, you know. I would just be in there being real thorough. And, you know, my parents are both attorneys. They figured this out real quick. About day 2, they're like, oh, you got a stomach ache, huh? I don't think so. And so I was lazy. I was always trying to get out of stuff. You might have one like that. And I had a really short fuse. I was irritable. I would argue and defend myself and all this stuff, that kind of things. And because my parents were both trained as attorneys, we knew how to argue in our family. We knew how to kind of logically present a case. And part of this was good. I remember the day that Dad taught us about a reasoned defense. He said, it's different than complaining. It's different than just arguing. It's explaining that if I walk in and I think you did something and you actually totally didn't, without getting upset, you can just explain respectfully, you know, I hear what you're saying, Dad, but actually, you know, this was already there and I'm not the one that broke this. It happened, you know, it fell off the shelf, or you can talk through things. Well, I was like, man, I could really run with that. So that reason defense thing, I would call that in every chance I got and just always be arguing about stuff. So I was just out of control. I wanted to run the family, really. I'd been around for 7 years and I thought I was ready to do that. And so my dad's dealing with this kind of stuff. And so he decided that the number one thing that our whole family needed out of me was a willingness to admit my own mistakes. Because everyone knew that I was making a lot of them. I mean, I was fist fighting with my brothers, fist fighting. You know, we had rules though. You couldn't kick each other below the belt or up in the face. But everything else was fair game. I don't really know how we had rules for how to fight when we were really, really mad, but we did. You know, we didn't know you know, that wasn't normal. But, and so Dad was thinking, if I'm going to get Paul, who's the biggest problem in my family, to begin actually admitting his mistakes and listening and stopping all this arguing and backtalk and disrespect and like sneaking around behind our backs and breaking rules and lying about it, I'm going to have to find some way to get him to take ownership over his own heart. Because rules and consequences are not getting through. He's a smart enough kid that he's just going to become a better liar. We just keep catching him and spanking him. He'd be like, well, that didn't work. He's a way better cover story than, well, the Russians attacked and I couldn't do my homework. You know, you got to get like a better strategy. And so he's like, I don't want to just build a smarter sinner. I want to actually reach his heart. And he knew the only way to do that was to model humility. And he couldn't model it in the abstract. You gotta prove to someone that it's worth it to really, really humble yourself when it's a little bit humiliating to humble yourself. And you can't do that by teaching on humility. You can only do that by actually practicing humility. And so when my dad would come home and he'd have the stress of work, whether it was as an attorney or then when he went to full-time ministry, when I was 7 years old, he was running a large organization and just all the stuff you deal with in the adult world, or whether he was having a day when he was just feeling under the load of the things from his background with a dad that had rage issues and a mom that struggled with depression and the trauma of these experiences. You know, he'd wake up in the morning and he would take those to the Lord, but when they'd boil over, he would admit it. He'd say, hey guys, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for being irritable. I'm sorry for being frustrated. Will you forgive me? And you know, it was sincere enough that we really knew he meant it. We really knew that he was sincere. And Dad has tried not just to teach scripture, but to live it. And in those moments, he would say, hey, this is an example, guys, where God's parenting me and I have to be willing to obey and submit and say, I'm sorry. And then later on, when my dad would confront me, and he wouldn't do it in anger, he wouldn't do it forcefully. Or later on when mom would talk to me and say, hey, there's some things you're doing that are just kind of breaking my heart. They're hurting our family. They're hurting your relationships with your siblings. They would have tremendous credibility to do that. They didn't have to yell to get my respect. Their words were so backed with the strength of their example that all they needed to really do was to have a heart-to-heart conversation. And at least in those moments, I would admit, yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. I mean, I'm doing what I shouldn't be doing. And when you do that, you sincerely and humbly apologize without making excuses or saying, well, it was 40% my fault and 60% his fault, or there were circumstances that made me act this way, whether they're like big boy circumstances, like my job was stressful, or little boy circumstances, like he hit me first. You know, it's the same thing. And so I began to really realize that my dad had credibility to ask me to admit my mistakes. Here's the second thing he did. After admitting when he would mess up, he actually entered my world. And he built just a friendship. I think sometimes we're so focused on training and teaching and trying to overcome issues and problems and trying to work on character qualities that we forget just to have relationships. You know, sometimes we Christian speaker types can do you all a real disservice when we try to make things, not necessarily for this purpose, but we can wind up making things sound pretty complex. Like if you were to Google, you know, character qualities or whatever, you can find lists of 50 or 100 character qualities. And then someone says it takes 3 intentional lessons to teach each quality, then you have to follow up. I mean, now you've gone from a list of 100 to now 300 action points, and this isn't even like academic yet. These aren't social skills. This isn't spiritual knowledge. These are qualities. You're thinking, this is just unbelievable, the number of things I'm supposed to teach my kids. And we do need curriculum and content. I'm not against those things at all. But one of the best places your kids can learn individual qualities and individual concepts and all these tiny things that probably would be an endless list, they can probably best learn some of those things just through time, living life with you. Because if I ask you, you know, how do you live your life? Why are you so mature compared to who you were as an 18-year-old? You know, how do you know how to make decisions? You probably won't say, well, actually, it's because there's this really great 100-item long list of character traits. And every moment, I think through my options and I think, well, what would the character trait of Christ-centered spontaneity tell me to do? You know, I mean, we don't really think this way. We just try to follow Christ and love others and apply the things that we know from Scripture as a lifestyle. And your kids will grasp that as they spend time with you. So my dad entered my world and just tried to have fun with us and spend time with us and play with us in terms of our hobbies, our interests. He'd come down and help me with building forts and just be my biggest fan. And that's the third idea. The third idea is to become your child's biggest fan. And so 1 through 3, if you can admit when you're wrong, if you can enter their world and become your child's biggest fan, that encouragement and those positive words of affirmation really can put you in a place where you're having a profound shaping impact on your children's lives. 4 is to invite honest feedback. When you open up the channel of communication from your child back to you, not in a moment of conflict when tensions are high, but in a normal moment when you plan ahead and you're not having an argument or a conflict, and you ask them, hey, what are some things that I could do that would make us closer? That's maybe a better question than saying, hey, what kind of criticisms would you have for your mom right now or for your dad? You know, because you can quickly move into a complaining, disrespectful scenario. But if you said, hey, I want to be as close to you as I can, what are some things I could do to move toward a closer relationship? That can be a great question. And then maybe they'll think, oh, I wonder if I should ask the same question back. And how great would it be if you had your children saying, hey, how could I have a better relationship with you? How could I be closer to you? And you can say, well, here's an idea. And then you're sharing a suggestion, not in a crisis when they've made a mistake and you're disciplining, but it's a moment when they're actually thinking, how can we be closer? And here's the final idea, is to never stop being parented by God. That's what my parents have modeled, where they take their hearts to Scripture and know that they're still in process and none of us ever become superheroes or perfect, but just that we're supposed to be open channels where the parenting love of God pours into our hearts and overflows into the lives of those that He's calling us to love. And that really is how, in our family, we arrived at perfection, to where everything was great, everything was just perfect.
All right, whoa, it's time for me to get up and give a little rebuttal.
All right, okay.
That's not how it was. Okay. So, hey guys, I'm Anna. I'm excited to be with you all this morning. And, you know, even though Dad and Paul have shared ways that they really grew in their relationship, and Dad talked and Paul talked about ways that their relationship was healing and Dad's relationship with Mom was really healing, I was really hurt by a lot of things that happened in our family. I was a very sensitive child, very kind of emotional, and I didn't talk a lot. I had a very talkative twin brother, and he kind of did most of the speaking for me. But I noticed everything, and I maybe didn't say a whole lot. But there was a whole lot going on in my mind and in my heart, especially as I was a kid. I took a lot of things in. And when Dad would come home from work and open the door in kind of a stressful way and kind of walk in and breeze through, make a few comments and go into the room, like that tension just radiated in the house. And I kind of took it all into myself and felt it. You know, sometimes I would kind of stay up in my room and hide out a little bit when Dad came home from work because I was just a little nervous, you know. Was it going to be relaxed and fun? Which, to be fair to him, he was most of the time. But those few times, you know, when he would come home and be stressed and maybe make a comment or get into a thing with mom, like that hurt me deeply. And my response to it wasn't proportional to kind of the times that happened with Dad, which is not a fair thing for you as a parent. But that's kind of one of the problems, you know, one of the challenges with having kids is they feel deeply the things that you do. You have such a vital role in their lives. And I grew up responding to Dad's tension and anger by just really kind of retracting and really being afraid. I remember one time when Dad and Mom were having a fight and I'd come down in the middle of the night to get a drink of water and I heard them come out of the room, the bedroom, and I snuck into the closet and just waited there kind of shaking and nervous because I was afraid. And it's not like there was no violence or anything like that, but just that relational tension as a sensitive girl wounded me very deeply. And so maybe you have someone in your family, maybe that happened to you, or that's kind of the way that you dealt with conflict, and there's a lot of pain there, even though all my parents did so many wonderful things with me growing up. And so Dad realized that when I was at a young age that we had a broken relationship, that there wasn't a lot of trust there, that I didn't really want to open up to him about how I was feeling. And he knew this because when he would take me out on dates, I would give him one-word answers and not really respond. And I think in my head, I was kind of thinking, you know, Dad has 5 other kids and a wife and a busy life, and he probably doesn't really care what's going on in my heart. And also, maybe I'm a little nervous to share what's really going on. But I remember Dad did not take no for an answer or one word answers as kind of the state that our relationship would be. He was intentional from the time I was young about taking me out and making sure that I knew I was a valued person in his life. And one way he did this is by taking me out on dates and not taking one word answers as kind of the last thing. I remember one time he took me out and just started asking me question after question after question for at least an hour, just about my life and what books I was reading and my friends. I was young at this point. And I just remember that it really got the message into my mind that he really cared about my life. You know, he cared about listening to me. And that was one of the things that really started to rebuild the trust that we had in our relationship, to rebuild the closeness, and to get this message in my mind: my dad, busy as he is, really cares about me and really cares about listening. I also had a problem in my family where I felt like Dad, when he would correct me, he would try a lot of times to help me through some of my issues. You know, I was very emotional and he wanted to help me, to teach me how to control my emotions so I didn't let them rule my life, right? Like, that's a great thing to do, a very important thing to do. But somehow I got the idea growing up that he was trying to fix me or change me, or that something about how I was innately was wrong, was messed up. And I think that helped to create, along with a lot of other things, some insecurity in my life and some fear of when Dad would give instruction, I heard it as criticism. And when Dad would offer advice, I heard it as, I'm messed up and you don't approve of me as a daughter. Now, was that what Dad was trying to communicate? Not at all. But I think the instruction, coupled with that pain I had from some of his anger, really made sure that I didn't really respond well and hear his heart in some of the instruction that he had. So if that's maybe where you are with one of your kids or with a spouse, I encourage you to take some time to really comfort the pain that maybe they've experienced, and maybe even confront the wrong understanding that they may have of your intentions. You know, as I got older and began to trust Dad more, I began to open up and say, you know, Dad, when you say that to me, this is what I hear. And one time I did that, even actually pretty recently with Dad, and he was like, oh, that's not at all what I intend to communicate to you. We had this kind of breakthrough moment where I realized maybe I'm responding things and thinking that he means things that he doesn't. And often that can happen when you have just very different personalities in a family and you really want to restore closeness there and a harmony that maybe there wasn't before. So I encourage you to build trust over time with your children, and that eventually invite them to share openly with you kind of maybe their impressions of how you're treating them, and there can be some amazing reconciliation that happens and a lot of hopefulness as you realize that you really can be closer than you ever thought you could before. One thing I'm grateful for is that Dad not only dad and mom not only discipled me, but they also modeled discipleship in the family. I remember when I was about 10, dad said, so, you know, Anna, how's your relationship with mom? We were on one of our dates. So I was like, oh, it's great. You know, how's your relationship with Abigail, my oldest sister? I was like, oh, it's fantastic. You know, how's your relationship with Paul? It's okay. Now, in girl speak, that was like red sirens saying, it's not okay, it's not okay, there's something wrong, you know. And dad didn't just care about his relationship with me. He cared about my relationship with Paul, our relationship as siblings, and that making up a tight network in the family that's so important. And so he realized there was a problem here. There was something not right between Paul and Anna. Paul was 14, I was about 10 at this point. And I remember him sitting us both down and saying, you know, guys, I really want y'all to work on your relationship. I promise you, you'll be grateful for it someday. And at this point, Paul was big, grumpy, irritable. I was sweet and kind, you know, and like not annoying at all and not sensitive or attending to emotional fits at all, right? So we just had this perfect recipe for a bad relationship. And I remember dad being like, you know, you guys should do something fun together. You should, Paul, you should take her on a picnic. And Paul was like, that's your generation, dad. That's not cool. Like, we don't do picnics. Like, you know, that's kind of weird. So instead, Paul was like, hey, I work out, you know, I work in the shop a lot. I make things with wood carvings. I think dad had the idea. Why don't you make something for Anna? And so I went down there one day and was talking to him. And, you know, Paul and I didn't have much of a friendship at this point. So this was a big step for us to just be spending time together where we weren't like arguing or we were talking. And he offered to make me a wooden stand for my doll, which like I needed a lot. I had a lot of dolls and needed to stand up, you know? So as we were doing that project together, we just found a lot of things to talk about because we were focused on something else. We weren't just sitting like at a restaurant, which would have been really awkward, you know, for these kids trying to build a friendship. And that was really the start to us realizing how much we had in common and, you know, working over a common project that helped us focus on just ways we could talk to each other and appreciate each other. And it wasn't something that created conflict in our relationship. Things like that over time actually really helped to rebuild my friendship with Paul. And now, I mean, we're best friends, you know, we're so close. And I'm so grateful to dad for just the way that he modeled that discipleship in our family and the way that I was able to have that relationship with Paul. And what's even cooler is that as I got older and in college, just really struggled with some insecurities and some issues in my life. The person who was there for me in a way that nobody else was my brother. You know, as an older guy who understood a lot of things I was going through, kind of growing up in the family and different issues I was working through with God, he discipled me in just an amazing way that I'm just going to be forever grateful for. And we wouldn't have had that relationship unless dad had rebuilt a relationship with me and unless I was willing to listen to his advice about how to have a relationship with other people in my family. Another thing that dad did is when I was about 10 years old, I moved into a room with my little sister who was 4. And he gave me a vision for how I was such an influential person in her life and how I could begin to disciple her even at a young age. And so there was this model in the family of Paul rebuilding his relationship with me and then me working through things with Susanna. And now she and I are, you know, really close and she disciples other girls. And there's this amazing kind of cascade effect of discipleship happening right in the family that all kind of happened because dad was just consistent in working to rebuild our relationship and to teach me how to disciple in the family. And one of the main things that he did to do that is one, as Paul mentioned, he just apologized. You know, he apologized and asked for my forgiveness and asked that I would give him grace. And at the same time, when I made mistakes, he would give me grace and mom and dad would give me grace. And so it was this beautiful picture in our family of being grace givers to each other and that creating kind of this effect of, you know, dad giving me grace and me giving dad grace and that unconditional love that a family is supposed to have was just what kind of changed our lives. You know, we didn't become perfect overnight. You know, I work with my parents now and it's wonderful, but there's a lot of times there's a lot of opportunity for apology and forgiveness even now. And there was something that I noticed that maybe if you're discouraged with like a child who is maybe more of an adult and you just feel like you're not as close or maybe they still are kind of holding on to some resentment and they've never really been able to forgive you fully. And that's probably really, I know it's really painful. And even though I'd forgiven my parents a lot, it wasn't until college that I experienced kind of a reawakening of my relationship with the Lord. I'd been a Christian for a long time, but I just had this moment where I kind of felt like I became a Christian all over again, you know, and kind of realized the depths of God's goodness and his love toward me and realized how much I had been forgiven by God. And that gave me so much more forgiveness to be able to extend to the people around me, because it wasn't something that was originating with myself. It was something that I was just a vessel to receive from God and give to the people around me. And I know that when that happened, my relationship with my dad especially took an even greater depth. And so don't be discouraged if maybe your relationship in your family isn't reconciled yet, but being consistent and forgiving and spending time with them and giving grace and apologizing and praying that God does a work in their heart, that God would do a work like he did in my heart, to be able to extend that forgiveness and reconcile, something that I'm so grateful for. So don't give up on your kids. Don't give up on their relationships with each other. I'm so glad my parents didn't, back when we were fighting and arguing all the time. They never would have imagined that we would have been best friends now. But we are, and I'm really grateful for their investment in us. Thanks.
Okay, that's it. Let me close in prayer. Lord, thank you for these faithful. I would ask you, Lord, that as you parent us, would be willing to parent others. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
At the National Center for Biblical Parenting, we have a number of practical resources for you. This presentation that you've just listened to is only one of many that we have to offer you.
We'd like you to visit us on the web at biblicalparenting.org and find some more resources to strengthen your family.